It's Friday, May 5th. A thousand-year-old tradition returns, but for how much longer? We start here. History will be made during the coronation of King Charles this weekend.
People's opinions about the monarchy have shifted considerably since she was queen.
The UK gearing up for the celebrations, but also wondering, is all this really necessary? The Justice Department gets a key verdict against a longtime leader of the Proud Boys.
Basically, all of these defendants are facing potential decades in prison.
What that might mean for the special counsel's investigation. And you could soon see something new on drugstore shelves.
And this is basically what a lot of women know as the mini pill.
The FDA looking to change the rules for a birth control medication. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Mark Remillard. Good morning. Brad is off today, so I'll be here in the meantime.
I too now solemnly pledge myself, throughout the remaining time God grants me, to uphold the constitutional principles at the heart of our nation.
On Saturday, for the first time in 70 years, the UK is going to celebrate the coronation of a new monarch. King Charles may have ascended to the throne after his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, died last year. But now is his day, his official coronation ceremony, on display for the world to see.
I shall endeavor to serve you with loyalty, respect, and love, as I have throughout my life.
For weeks and months, preparations have been underway. ABC News foreign correspondent James Longman is in London and here to break down everything we expect to see. So, James, first, let's just go over the plan. What do we expect to see on Saturday?
Well, so it all kicks off on Saturday morning, where Charles and Camilla ride in the King's procession, is what it's called officially, from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Abbey. That is where they will be crowned, King and Queen, in a ceremony that's going to take about an hour and a half. That's half the time that Queen Elizabeth took for her ceremony back in 1953.
Is Your Majesty willing to take the oath?
I am willing.
It'll also be a lot smaller, 2,000 people or thereabouts in attendance, rather than the 8,000 that she had. And then they'll come back in a procession back to Buckingham Palace in what's called the Coronation Procession. That's where we'll see the very famous gold state carriage pulled by horses from the King's stable back to Buckingham Palace. Then you'll see all of the working members of the royal family up on the balcony for that famous balcony shot. There'll be a flypast from the Royal Air Force. And then the weekend of celebrations will begin. The invite has gone out around the world. Heads of state, as would usually be invited, they're going to come along. Jill Biden, the First Lady, will represent the United States. But for the first time, foreign royals and foreign monarchs are going to be invited, which actually traditionally didn't used to happen.
As far as I see it, the divide couldn't be greater before this book.
Prince Harry will be here, but his wife Meghan has decided to stay back in California. It's their son Archie's birthday over the weekend, so the decision was made. We're told that she would stay in California. He will be here just for 24 hours.
Me and my family can reconcile, can put our differences behind us, but first there needs to be conversation and accountability.
There will be a lot of people watching the body language. Where is Harry going to sit? In the Abbey, he's going to be closer to his brother. Where he sits will be dictated by protocol, given that he's no longer a working member. But the optics, and after all, is there anything else other than optics in these situations, will be very, very important to people.
How is the public receiving this event? Is part of, you know, I think it's easy to get caught up in the pomp and circumstance of all of this, and that may be exciting, but there might be some of those who are wondering why all this time and expense, but it sounds like this is actually a little bit of a curtailed ceremony compared to, as you mentioned, the differences between what happened during Queen Elizabeth II's coronation.
Yeah, they're trying to show the public that they are making it smaller than Queen Elizabeth's coronation, because they do recognize that, you know, people's opinions about the monarchy have shifted considerably since she was queen. You know, and so the first poll that was done on Brits and the monarchy was done only in the 1980s, and about 80% of people said that they supported the monarchy. We're now down to about 55% of people. So they are conscious of that.
When do we want democracy?
When do we want it?
Now!
But for people across Britain who are concerned about the cost and the fact that we're in a cost of living crisis at the moment, they just look at the whole thing and think, well, why are we doing any of this even if it is smaller.
We'll be chanting "Not My King" as he goes past.
It doesn't feel like they're giving us anything back.
I would like to see one of them come out here, come sweep this street.
We're still going to celebrate enormous wealth on display in front of us. I mean, we're literally going to parade the crown jewels through London.
I can see why people get very annoyed because they are very rich. But that's just history, really, isn't it?
People will put those reservations to one side for the day. I'm sure people will get excited when it begins.
And so we should really cherish it and be thankful for all that pageantry and all that nonsense that people might think, but it's our nonsense and it's beautiful.
There's going to be a massive boost to the economy. We're told people are going to go out and spend a lot of cash over the weekend, which is always good, especially with Britain's economy struggling as it is.
And this is my first time here in London.
We're excited to see what Kate's going to wear.
Oh yeah, the
and
colours.
Camilla.
But beyond that, you know, Charles has an uphill struggle to retain the public's affection for the monarchy.
I have in my parents and grandparents an example which I can follow with certainty and with confidence.
So, among other things, when we look back at Elizabeth II's coronation, it's remembered, obviously, for her coronation and what it meant for the monarchy at that moment, but it's also remembered as being the first one that was televised. I guess this one will be the first one that's, what, you know, live-streamed. There's going to be a lot of important historical aspects of this. Can you speak to some of what, you know, what might we be talking about decades down the road about the coronation of King Charles?
Wow. Well, I mean, we might be talking about the last coronation of its kind, because the person I'm going to be looking at a lot is Prince William. He's going to be watching this and thinking to himself, what's my coronation going to look like in, let's say, 10 years, 15 years? It's not that far away. Will he be able to spend millions and millions of pounds on a public celebration? Or will he say to himself, actually, the time is now to cut with all these huge, long-held traditions and actually try to replicate the monarchies on the continent? Because it's completely stripped back. I mean, they don't have coronations. They have political ceremonies where they go to the legislature and they present their credentials and they're essentially sworn in as heads of state. And that's it. There's no religious element. Now, this coronation, the one we do in Britain, is the only one of its kind anywhere, and it has remained pretty much unchanged since 1066. But could William be the first king to say, you know, popularity is slipping, do we have to leave all this behind? So I'll be sitting there thinking, I'm not sure if I'll ever see a coronation like this again.
All right, changing tide for the monarchy, no question. We'll be watching this major event on Saturday and all of the history that comes with it. ABC's James Longman, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Next up on Start Here, it's a law that rarely sees its day in court. Now the DOJ has successfully deployed it twice within the past year. That's after the break.
With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thank you.
It's been more than 2 years since supporters of former President Trump stormed the U.S. Capitol, hoping to block the certification of Joe Biden as president. And since that time, the Justice Department has been bringing case after case.
This is the most wide-ranging investigation and the most important investigation that the Justice Department has ever entered into.
Some have been for assaulting Capitol police officers, others for destroying property. Well, on Thursday, federal prosecutors secured what might be their most significant convictions yet. ABC's Justice Department reporter Alex Mallon has been following this trial for months. Alex, tell us about these verdicts yesterday.
Yeah, so after nearly 4 months, a jury in D.C. has returned guilty verdicts for seditious conspiracy against the Proud Boys leader Enrique Tarrio, three of his top lieutenants, and another Proud Boy who was not convicted of seditious conspiracy, but who was found guilty on a number of felony charges. Basically, all of these defendants are facing potential decades in prison based on the felony charges that they were all collectively convicted of yesterday. And this is basically probably the most important, I would argue, conviction secured by the Justice Department in its more than 2 year investigation into the Capitol attack. We already have convictions for leaders of the Oath Keepers militia group. Six of those members were found guilty at trials late last year and early this year. But the Proud Boys conspiracy was more touching on the violence that we saw take place at the Capitol that day. Prosecutors presented a mountain of digital evidence, thousands of text messages, hours and hours of audio that showed just how close these Proud Boys were to the nexus of all the violence at those barricades where we saw officers engaging with protesters. One of the defendants in this case, Dominic Pozzola, who was found not guilty of seditious conspiracy, was that rioter that we saw in that infamous video using a stolen police riot shield to smash through a window of the Capitol. This really was, in terms of the importance for the Justice Department to show that these two conspiracies between the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers, it was basically they've reached the top of the triangle. They found that they charged these two conspiracies in order to say that this was an organized event, something that was planned in advance to stop the peaceful transfer of power from President Trump to Joe Biden.
As you mentioned there, first, there were some of the leaders of the Oath Keepers convicted of seditious conspiracy. Now, some of the leaders of the Proud Boys, including former leader Enrique Tarrio. It seems like the Justice Department has pretty consistently been able to clear that bar, the hurdle of showing that there was a conspiracy here to try and overthrow the government on January 6th.
Yeah, and there was a lot of internal debate, Mark, and before these seditious conspiracy charges were even brought in the Justice Department. They were seeking to find a way to show that the Capitol attack was this genuinely serious threat to democracy. And so the charge of seditious conspiracy itself is rarely deployed. The last successful convictions the Justice Department was able to secure on that charge were about 15 years ago, and they've had failures trying to bring them in the years past that. So when they decided to bring these charges against the Oath Keepers and then later the Proud Boys, there was that internal debate that was going on. And I guess yesterday what we saw with those convictions was that was largely validated. I mean, and we saw Attorney General Merrick Garland come to the podium.
Today, the Justice Department secured the conviction of four leaders of the Proud Boys for seditious conspiracy related to the January 6th attack on the Capitol.
And really congratulate his prosecutors, congratulate the investigative team who have worked for 2+ years amid all this internal debate of how to handle such a massive event as an assault on the U.S. Capitol.
So we know that there are other cases stemming from January 6th that are still outstanding, whether these be just people who breached the Capitol and were involved in the actual violence on that day. Are we expecting any more charges related to seditious conspiracy, these really heavy charges in that respect?
We don't have any indication of that right now in terms of the rioters who were on the ground that day. Basically, the Justice Department identified and has now prosecuted those two kind of triangle conspiracies of Oath Keepers. There were dozens of Oath Keepers on the ground. There were more than 100 Proud Boys on the ground on January 6th, but they isolated that leadership of both groups and prosecuted them with that seditious conspiracy charge, basically, alleging that those leaders Stuart Rhodes for the Oath Keepers, and then now Enrique Tarrio for the Proud Boys. Rhodes was on the grounds of the Capitol, but was not ever alleged to have entered the Capitol. Tarrio was not even in Washington, D.C. But what prosecutors were able to prove here was that they were, both leaders were involved in directing their followers, essentially during the attack, directing their movements and making sure that they didn't leave the Capitol once it was breached.
And what does this mean for the special counsel Jack Smith and his investigation going forward? We know there's a lot of different tentacles of his investigation, but one of them is January 6th and what happened that day.
So when Attorney General Garland appointed Jack Smith, he made sure to effectively separate the investigation by the DC U.S. Attorney's Office into the rioters on the ground and the work by Jack Smith into Trump and his allies' efforts to overturn the election more broadly. But I think that what you will see is Smith was probably watching this verdict closely, because the important part of bringing a seditious conspiracy charge against somebody who was not even in Washington, D.C., cross that over to people like Trump and his allies who were not at the Capitol. But if you were to bring a conspiracy charge against them, you want to be sure that a jury would accept that if they weren't physically among the rioters who were assaulting the Capitol that day.
All right, we'll keep an eye on this story and how it plays out going forward. ABC's Alex Mallon joining us. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
As the fight over abortion continues in state houses and courtrooms across the country, the FDA has repeatedly found itself at the center of the debate over reproductive rights.
This is not about the Constitution and Dobbs. This is really about a regulatory decision to approve a drug 23 years ago.
Currently, federal courts are weighing a case concerning the FDA's approval of a common abortion medication. And now the FDA is considering whether to change how women across the country access birth control. ABC senior national policy reporter Ann Flaherty joins us now to break this down. And Ann, what is the FDA thinking of doing?
So the FDA is considering this application by HRA Pharma. This is a French drug maker that produces the progestin-only drug called Opill. And this is basically what a lot of women know as the mini pill. So it's a daily birth control pill that you would take. It's been on the market. It's been approved by the FDA since 1973.
You don't want birth control, but you want control of women. And that's our fight.
So what advocates have been working toward and what the drug company wants to do is to say, you know, this is safe enough. We think that you should be able to sell this over the counter without a prescription and without any age restrictions. So putting it up there with, you know, the nasal sprays, the allergy medicines, and just making it a regular, easily accessible medication that people can take so that they don't have to go to a doctor's appointment and get all those refills once a year. So, you know, the pro to this is obviously access. The con to this is people would be less likely to engage their doctors. That's one concern that people have.
Yeah. And whenever the FDA makes a change to any medication, people want to know what the safety risks of this are, the safety impacts are. So as you mentioned, this medication's been around for a while, but how does allowing access to it without that prescription or a doctor visit impact those safety concerns?
Well, so what the OBGYNs will tell you is this is one of the safest birth control pills that you can take. It's actually known to have fewer risks than combined pills, combination pills that have estrogen in them.
We give the pill in gynecology and women's health for so many reasons. Women who have severe menstrual cramps, menstrual migraines, PMS, and the list goes on and on.
So what the FDA, what we expect today to happen is they're probably going to release what they call their briefing book or their data analysis on this drug. This is going to be a really detailed look at every known safety risk related to this drug. Now, I think worth noting the American Medical Association, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, everybody is pretty much lining up behind this. They say this is an extraordinarily safe drug. You know, every medication has risks. You have to take those risks into account and you have to screen yourself. But their argument is they think that patients can screen themselves and have these any known risks that they can probably determine whether or not this drug makes sense for them. The FDA has to, though, consider that. Is this something that the general population can take? And I think one thing that they're going to be looking at are the age restrictions. You know, is this something that you would feel comfortable if a 16-year-old was taking on their own without telling their parents? I think that's going to come up. So that's one question there.
Is there a reason this is coming down now? Is the FDA trying to get ahead of something or concerns about the potential future of access to birth control?
Well, so, you know, what's interesting is this isn't FDA driven. This has actually been driven by advocates and then the company itself. I talked with people from Free the Pill. This is a coalition of advocates that exists entirely to try to increase access to birth control pills.
In some of our national research in the United States, we have found that something around 30%, so a third of folks trying to access a method via a prescription face a barrier.
They say that hormonal birth control pills are safe enough. They should be available everywhere and that it shouldn't be this difficult for patients to get access to something that is just such a basic need. So, for example, I talked with one woman, Angela Maskey. She talked about, you know, her concerns trying to find it as a college freshman because she was going to a Catholic affiliated university.
I was 18 years old. I had just started college as a freshman. I was in a new city. And I knew that one of the first things I wanted to do when I got to campus was to get prescribed the birth control pill.
Their policy was that they wouldn't prescribe hormonal birth control for sexual contraception. So she had to go out and find a doctor, and it took her 3 months to do so.
3 months longer than I really wanted it to. I wanted to like just get it quickly as soon as I got to campus.
I think a lot of women have those stories where they run out of birth control pills and then they have to scramble to find a new prescription. This group has been fighting solely for increased access for the pill because they feel so strongly that women need to have reproductive control.
Birth control pills are one of the most popular contraceptive methods in the United States. The impact could be really significant for many, many people.
This is what they've been working toward for years, they tell me, that this is this important to them. And so the FDA is considering this application. They're going to be looking primarily at the science. They're not advocates. They're not going to be looking at the cultural impact of this. They're going to be looking at whether or not it makes sense for American patients.
Women's rights are human rights!
I feel like it really took kind of this fever pitch after the Dobbs decision last year, where these organizations started to get a little bit more momentum, where people said, wow, this really matters. Because if you're going to have so many states, right now at least 15 states have ceased nearly all abortions, then you're going to have to look at the birth control issue. And right now it is difficult to get access to birth control, particularly for women in rural areas, women who struggle to find transportation. If you've got kids, you might need to arrange for childcare. It's not necessarily easy. So when they're looking at it through that lens of abortion being restricted, that makes the most sense to them that it should be available just in a pharmacy to pick up.
What is it going to be next? Is that judge going to not like birth control pills? Are we going to have a judge that doesn't like Lipitor? There is a reason that Congress gave FDA the power to make these decisions about safety.
So certainly there's a political element to this where people are trying to increase access for women in areas where abortion, for example, would be severely restricted.
And even though, as you said, the FDA is not an advocacy organization, the decisions they make have sometimes led to pushback. Do we expect to see some pushback or organization saying, I don't know, maybe challenging this decision or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. I think you definitely see the more conservative groups have accused the FDA of being politicized. That's what we saw with the abortion drug mifepristone when the FDA said that they thought that that was safe enough to be prescribed in pharmacies rather than only through abortion clinics. That led to a big lawsuit that eventually is going to make its way to the Supreme Court. We're still waiting on the Fifth Circuit decision on that. There were filings from the Catholic Church or Catholic-affiliated groups that said that they were concerned about two things. They were still concerned about the medical risk, and they were concerned about teens accessing medication without their parents knowing. Well, I spoke to one 17-year-old high school senior who's advocating for easier access to the birth control pill. She says, you know what? I think they underestimate us, and teens will, you know, work hard at things that interest them and they will do the work that they need to do. So she was very adamant that teens could handle this. But of course, I think that's going to be a question that will come up today with the FDA and its analysis and next week when the scientific advisors take this up.
Yeah, no doubt. We'll see how this plays out. ABC's Ann Flaherty, thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, your passwords are probably bad. The good news is you might not need them that much longer. One last thing is next.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking in that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 Central on ABC.
And one last thing. I don't know about you, but I hate passwords. Trying to remember them, having to come up with funky ways of writing them, like no one can crack this code because I used a 3 instead of the letter E. I also hate when I get an email from a company I signed up for a decade ago telling me to change my password because they've had a data breach. Well, all of those headaches could soon be a thing of the past. Mike, do you use a password manager, or are you all like 123456?
So I was really pretty bad with my password habits up until very recently, Mark.
ABC's Mike Dubusky covers tech for us and says Google is the latest in a growing number of tech companies to announce that the future is passwordless.
So this week, Google announced support for this new technology called passkeys.
He says instead of typing a password, the passkey is locally stored on your device, and your device acts as your login.
It's a key. Your phone acts as a key, and the lock, that is the equivalent of that, is the account that you're trying to get into, whether that's Best Buy or eBay or Shopify. Basically, however you get into your phone now, whether it's through a face scan or through a fingerprint or through just a simple security code, so long as you can get into your phone, you can get into the website that you're trying to log into.
Not only does this system mean no more remembering and changing pesky passwords, it's also more secure.
If someone were to hack into Best Buy and steal all the passwords, they wouldn't get anything of value because I have the key. It's stored locally on my device.
Not everyone supports this yet, so it might be some time before we can forever say goodbye to passwords, but major companies like Microsoft, Apple, and others are rolling this out, and Dubusky says Google is an important player.
Google supports this, which means that Android supports this. That's basically half of the US smartphone market.
And passwords could go the way of the floppy disk. Now the only thing left to do is try and explain how to sign up for passkeys to my less than tech-friendly family members right after I explain what a podcast is. Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Brenda Salinas-Baker, Vika Aronson, Iru Ekpunobi, Cameron Chertavian, Anthony Ali, and Tara Gimbel. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is director of podcast programming. Brad Milkey is our managing editor. Laura Mayer is our executive producer. Thanks to Lakia Brown, John Newman, and Liz Alessi. And special thanks this week to Chris Berry, Jared Kofsky, and Maya Rosenfeld. I'm Mark Remillard. Have a great weekend.
Wednesday night on ABC, Brittany Griner, for the first time since being released from a Russian prison, shares her story.
You've been told to go through your bag, and you felt...
Felt the cartridge.
What were you thinking in that moment when you felt that?
My life is over right here.
Her sentence.
Just been told you're going to be 9 years in one of the worst prisons in Russia.
I was just so scared for everything, because there's just so much unknown.
Brittany Griner, Robin Roberts, Prisoner in Russia, Wednesday night at 10, 9 Central on ABC.